I'm sure many of you have questions and follow-ups, so we'd like to have a bit of a conversation generally first. We do have roving mics, and then what we'd like to do is ask our panelists to go down and join you and have maybe more private conversations. But if you could maybe indicate if you've got questions, could I maybe kick off with you, Patrick? When you said you felt there was a distortion of what the Republican struggle was all about, when you see the outworking of that struggle and personal tragedy, how do you feel about that? Does it change? I think you've said that in the same circumstances you would do the same again. How do the personal stories feed into how you feel?
I don't think I ever made such a blunt statement as that I would do the same again, because I don't think that like that. That's a separate matter. The one thing that's very clear, that there are different narratives and they're in contention, and that people from the Republican communities, nationalist communities, while not all on having the exact same view, you know, have a different view from this other narrative out there that's in opposition to it. And I don't know of any way other than to have an engagement with those two narratives to move on. And it has to be done in such a way that there's proper listening, that we really do listen to the other person's story, and that our story in turn is heard, and that there's mutual respect for it.
And I think there are competing narratives, there's no question about that, but the two narratives seem so far apart at the moment. When you say that basically it's a lack of opposition, there was no justification, you know, this is a very difficult conversation for everybody today, but do you see any movement in those two narratives, as Patrick says, some common ground where we could listen to each other?
I think we definitely have to listen to each other. I think that's without a doubt. However, I do think that this cannot be any justification for taking a life. There can't be any justification. Look, my parents got up that day, and my sister, she went into the bathroom to have her shower and got dressed and was thinking about what she was going to be doing that day, was to go and bring her little primary three boys to Mass in St. Agnes' Church to make their first confession. And the gunmen and Mary McArdle and the man who hid the gunmen, and now he's dead, and I could mention his name, but I actually have huge respect for his family, so I won't do that. They got up that morning. I don't know if they had a breakfast. I don't know what they thought whenever they put on their clothes. But they knew that by that evening there was going to be at least one person murdered, if not multiple. And the men who murdered my sister were wearing wigs. They were in disguise. She had no chance to defend herself. My father didn't carry a gun. It was an unfair situation. And I often think, Patrick, you know, like the day that you planted the bomb in the hotel, and I think about, you know, for example, Lord Tebbit's family and him and his wife, having their shower, cleaning their teeth, getting into bed, preparing the next day, thinking they're going to be at a conference. And instead their lives have been destroyed. And I just, you know, I find it hurtful. And if I find it hurtful, I know, as I said, I'm not unique. And if I find it hurtful to hear, all I want to hear is for somebody to say, and that probably means senior Sinn Féin, to be honest, as well, I want somebody to say, we had no right to take your father's life. Your dad was a good man. He was doing a job. He had six children to support. He'd only become a judge in 1980. He had a sister's practice, but two of his colleagues left him in 1978 because they were Protestants and they thought they weren't getting enough work because he was a Catholic. And he had a mortgage to pay and college fees to pay. Policemen were doing their job. You know, they put on a uniform and they went out and they did their job and they were lit up. And then for the you know, so I'm sorry, I just don't, I find it hurtful. You know, I personally, I find it really hurtful. I know it was Gerry Kelly who said a couple of years ago in Castledare that if he had to, he would do it all again. And you know what I thought whenever he said that? I pictured my parents and my sister walking home from Mass and then being murdered all over again. And there's one thing that we all have to be mindful of. It's like people like me, people like commentators, politicians, when you speak in the airwaves, when you say something out public, you've got to be very, very mindful that there are people sitting at home that you severely risk by re-traumatising by one single word or sentence without thinking about it.
Joan, in your reconciliation work and building bridges, is this something that you come across quite often, that there isn't an understanding of each story? Is that part of your work, to get people to tell their stories and understand each other better? Is that something that you come across?
Yes. And in every conflict, what happens is that one group sees the other as less than human. And when Pat planted that bomb, I said before, he wasn't seeing anyone as human beings. They were a means. And I've heard him say, and I'm not sure he'll say it today, but I've heard him say that he couldn't have done it. Now he knows my dad. Now he knows what a wonderful human being. He couldn't plant that bomb. And so the work is about rehumanising each other, making sure no one is demonised, and working a lot in the Muslim community in England, who are being really demonised at the moment. And we all have that potential to dehumanise another. But I think what Anne has so movingly articulated is what happens when people are demonised, and it shouldn't happen. And I'm just so moved by your story. And the work is about really finding ways to hear people's stories, because I know especially from a workshop that I did with Maureen Hebbington back in 2000, when people came together to share their stories, and the end of the weekend, and there were people from all different sides, was just that building bridges, just seeing the humanity in each other. You know, and that's what we have to do, because I truly believe that almost all the killing in the world wouldn't happen if we see the other in their full humanity. Yeah. And that is the work. That is the work we're all doing, and it needs to happen.
I think there's a story about the end of World War II, the Warsaw Uprising in Poland. And there's a memorial to the people who took part in it when they were trying to drive the Germans out of Warsaw. There's a bronze sculpture, and they actually, the Nazi soldiers, the German soldiers, are portrayed as having no faces, because to give them a face would humanise them. And I think that's the point, actually, that they should humanise them, because they were human beings as well. And that's the sort of work that more is needed. Is that fair comment? Does anybody have any other questions that we want to? Sorry, there are a couple down here at this table.
Distrust of each other and our different stories and experiences. I can't undo all of that. All I can do is present myself, try to be as honest as possible, be in the moment, and respect the people I'm sharing the platform with and the audience. And hopefully that in itself will be an example of what needs to be done, which is engage in these difficult conversations. I remember going back to that first meeting with Joe, and it's 15 years ago, and I'm repeating myself, thinking all I had to do was give our account of what was in our heads at the time, you know, what motivated us to take on the British state as we saw it, and that would be enough. But clearly there's so much pain as a legacy of our conflict that more is needed, and we have to find a means of furthering that, those difficult conversations, and catch up on the pain, deal with it. I remember forming this picture out of nothing about Joe's father. Let me explain what I mean. The time of Brighton, I wouldn't have given much thought to the people in the hotel. There would have become some concern that staff in the hotel were not caught up in the ball. But beyond that, anybody who was in that hotel, I wouldn't have given any thought to them. I was dealing with a label, I was dealing with a category. There were Tories, there were people in power, they were the people we held most culpable for the oppression in our streets and what was happening in our streets. So I wouldn't have given any thought. Then, so Joe's father was a cipher, in other words. He wasn't a human being in that. I had no nothing in my head about the man. I'm hearing about him, and so you're getting some sense of his humanity and goodness, because the value, the worth, the humanity I perceived in Joe, I realised must have come in some measure from him, and that I'd killed this guy. And I say, and it's that moment that you make this connection of the loss, and somehow as a society coming out of conflict, we have to get a measure of that loss, you know, all of the pain, and there's no community that has remained aloof from that suffering. We all have our grievances. Somehow we have to find a means of sharing that loss, and you know, taking responsibility for it.
Yeah. Can I just say, I was really nervous about today, and I was nervous Patrick was sitting with you, but I'm glad to have this opportunity to have this, to have this conversation. I think that and actually I think you're really brave coming and sitting with me, because obviously you don't know what I might come out with. But I wish the 40 years ago, I wish that whenever this all started, that people start to see humanity and people as human beings. You know, the reason my dad couldn't carry a gun was because he knew he couldn't take another human being's life. He knew he could never use it. He was offered a police bodyguard. There's no way he could take a father or husband away from another family if they were killed instead of him. And when I was 17, I learned how to drive. I saw my sister's friend walk across the Malone Road at Methody at those traffic lights. And my mum was in the car beside me. And he was crossing over, and I sped up, and quite literally braked, and he was about this much away. The most piercing blue eyes, And my mum turned to me and put her hand on my knee and said, "Anne, don't. Don't. You'll be as bad as them." And that's not, you know, it's not to insult you, Pat. I'm just saying there was a choice, you know. I work in a wee mini market where actually there was a guy there. I didn't read it, but he must have had all the loyalist tattoos. I don't know. Maybe he was. I don't know what he was. But anyway, he offered to get the lads to go to sort your man out because he used to keep on coming into the shop. And I said, no, I couldn't do that. And I remember my brother Paul meeting them and wanting to bash his face in. And he walked away. And I just wish that this all happened a long time ago. And the consequence of it now isn't just us sitting here, but it's the transgenerational stuff, you know. It wasn't just my family that were affected by Mary's murder, it was her little the boys in that class who were affected, who are now young men, who still keep in contact with my family. I know women whose grandchildren don't know what their granddad did because they just don't talk about it. We don't talk about it. Who wants to talk about it? I mean, you're told to move on all the time. We're told we have to not talk about it. Move on. And then trying to protect themselves too, you know.
There are many people within the Republican community deeply affected as well. You know, maybe young men who became involved and suffered mental health problems and all sorts of problems in later life. It's a fairly deep hurt throughout the community, isn't it?
Well, one of the real, you know, ironies in my life is that there was a time when I would have called myself a pacifist, and I mean that in that sense of being anti-war. I was in the 60s, you know, and you looked at the world and you didn't like it, and you didn't like the abuses of power, and it made you very anti-militaristic. And then suddenly you're in Belfast and you're seeing what's happening in the streets, and you're seeing how our communities responded to that. And I'm not saying everybody in those communities responded in the same way, but there was a common enough view of what was needed to be done, and I became deeply affected by that and respected it and wanted to be a part of it, wanted to contribute to what people in those very poor districts were doing to combat the ready state. And which led me to get involved in the struggle. And yes, I mean, there's no community immune from the suffering. It is a general point. But we all have been affected, and it's changed us. And now we're out of that conflict and having to deal with it. All of us, you know, I believe.
Sorry, there's another question, I think, from the middle of the floor, was there?
No, nobody has ever approached me. I remember when Mary McCarthy was appointed, I was asked by actually the then commissioner, Brendan, I forgot the surname, McAllister. Because he used to be a probation officer in the prison and he knew Mary McArdle, if I'd like to meet her. And I said, no, I wasn't ready. And then Karen Cullen did ask if I wanted to meet her. And I said, well, look, only if I can meet Mary McArdle as well. And she can give me some answers, but she didn't want to meet me. And yes, I would like to meet. I mean, I don't know. The person who shot my dad, who my dad believed shot him, was acquitted. And Mary McCarran was the only person who was ever convicted. And she knows the answers to who. I don't know who murdered Mary. We've no name, never been given a name. So yes, I would. I would welcome it. I was saying to Joe earlier on, I don't think I wouldn't be doing this, but I would like to go into a room and have a conversation with them. So I think with the Stormont House Agreement, I think that that's something which they have got there, if it ever comes about. Personally, I would like that, but that's not for everybody. And I think we all have to remember we're all unique.
Sorry, was there a comment? Yeah.
Hey, I'm deeply moved by what you've been saying this morning. I was 7 years in school with you in Hugh's class.
God help you. Except I'm his sister. At least you got rid of him after 7 years.
But I think I said earlier about the level of dis-ease that we have in Northern Ireland as a special, that we are a place apart because of your testimony, not just two narratives, but there are 3,500 narratives multiplied by all those lives that have been affected. Paul Nolan's peace report that comes out regularly through CRC says that 45% of our population knows someone who has been taken through the conflict. 27% of our population are economically inactive because we have the highest levels of emotional and mental distress. We have higher levels of suicide in Northern Ireland. We are still suffering, but to hear so eloquently, so personally, I just wanted to say thank you very much, because it helps eliminate just the struggle that we've all been through, but the very particular difficulty and challenge that you have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I actually think on what you've said is just so true. I mean, I know certainly that my education was destroyed by what happened to us, and I know a lot of prisoners, whenever they went into prison, they got degrees and they were able to use their time like that. Whereas a lot of the victims have no education or find it hard, like epoxy degrees, you know, they didn't actually go on and do what they should have been doing if they hadn't been affected. I believe very strongly, and this is where I actually agree with Mike Nesbitt, that Northern Ireland should become a place of excellence for mental health. And I think that we need to really focus in on it to help make people strong. And whenever people are strong, then they can talk, they can share their stories, they can share platforms like this and not be afraid to do it. You know, Patrick isn't the bogeyman. You know, whenever you see, if I was to see Patrick walking down the street, I wouldn't know what his past was. He wouldn't know what my past was or who I was. And I think that we need to be able to get together, no matter how hard it is. And it is hard, and there'll be people who'll criticise me for sitting up here today. But hey, this is what we have to do. We do it because we want to have a better future for our children, our grandchildren. You know, that's why we're doing it, and for ourselves.
Take a final question at this stage. Does anybody want to? Sorry, hit at the back.
I'd like to first of all acknowledge and appreciate your amazing contributions this morning. I just said a great favor, praying for treatment of righteousness. And if you haven't been in that situation, sometimes it's hard to appreciate, it's very difficult in this. So I really want to thank you. It's very important that we hear voices that we would otherwise hear because of the segregation of our society. As you said, Joe, it's really, really important that we humanize and rehumanize that we're seeing in our life. And we have to ask the difficult questions of the role of violence and the consequences of violence across all the society and absolutely everybody else we have to account. What I want to say is that more importantly, what we're dealing with now is a sense of this, of how we inscribe the names of those who have died into the landscape of memory. And it's a difficult issue, and again, it came up this morning about the name of a bridge and the name of somebody who was involved in the conflict. The sense of that is around that. Of people who have to live day to day with the trauma that they will lose their rights with, but yet the memory is held there by the dominant narratives that are held in the landscapes. So it's about how we actually inscribe those memories and how Stormont, the Northern Ireland Executive, the role of local councils, how they take responsibility and sensitivity the general perpetrator of awful atrocities on the community, and I don't care by whom, that there are consequences for those who have been hurt. People who have been hurt, how they have developed that, and the trigger and the trauma as a result of that. So there's lessons for our politicians on the storm, and local councils, and any statutory bodies of any responsibility about how we describe the dominant narratives and the names of people in the landscape of memory. We must be sensitive to people who have been hurt directly.
Anybody else at this stage wants to ask a question? We can move it around.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
My name is Sarah Casey. I've been involved in community work since I came to live in the city in 1973. My question is about poverty. And is it about your poverty or my poverty? Is it about your new education or my new education? Is it about your poverty having an outside child and no job? My family, the family and I said to have a job. And so we have now, for the first time since 1998, devolved administration with two extremes, both involved in some way, directly or indirectly, in conflict, living and working together in a big house on the hill, defining policy for our streets here in this shared society. Working out a shared future strategy, working out how to deal with issues of segregation and issues of poverty and child poverty. And you remember that you're in a city now that has neighborhoods of 60% child poverty. And you know it doesn't really matter if you're wearing a pink shirt or an orange shirt or a black shirt or a brown shirt. It's poverty. So therefore, as Maureen says, we need to demand from this conference today, and I ask CO3 to make sure that someone at the conclusion remarks that we look at the whole issue of how public policy has targeted achievable outcomes within the high counties on how to alleviate poverty and child lack of education and all of those issues that cause rise to come.
Thank you. Any more questions at this stage?
Dissidents to stop them from killing?
Well, I don't think there's any justification for the use of violence in the present circumstances. I know Anne and perhaps many of us in this room will feel there was never justification. That's another conversation. But I see no justification for the use of violence. We've got the means now to further whatever our grievances are in an open political way. Mm. And that's what I would support. So I obviously would be opposed to what the distance, so-called distance, are about.
Just very quickly, you know, there was Prison to Peace, and actually I think they've got, ex-prisoners have got more funding to go in and they talk in schools to school children. I would like to see victims. I would like school children and teenagers to see what the effects of violence is. And as I said when I was talking, it just doesn't finish after the funeral. It carries on and it carries like a pebble being thrown into the pond. You've all heard it. It's like the ripple effect going out. I think that we have to look for solutions now. You know, it's no point in we can talk, but we must come up with concrete solutions. and achievable solutions, those tiny tickable achievable steps. Told you I'd get it in. And that's what we have to do to move forward. I see the distance as people who obviously, a lot of it saddens me actually whenever I see, you know, people been arrested and you hear and they're 29 or they're, and you think, oh my God, you don't have a clue. What are you doing? You know, they just don't have an idea. But I think they should get, you should get more stories being told, education in school, let the victim's stories be part of the curriculum and their CS, whatever it is, CSP in the South, I don't know what it is here, that civic studies thing. And get talking.
Do you want to add something at this stage? Do you have a conscious hand?
Yes, sorry.
No, that was... Oops. I agree with everything you just said. Thank you.
I mean, certainly get the impression, Patrick, that there's no appetite, apart from a few, there's no appetite for a return to the armed struggle. Is there a danger that if we don't, as Anne says, move society forward, share society, get a solution, that a future generation will return to an armed struggle?
I'm 64 now, and I'm a generation where I become more patient with age. I can remember a time when I had no patience at all, when you wanted to change now, or you wanted 10 years previous, you know. And all I can say is that we somehow have to overcome the fear out there, fear looking into the future where we can't keep up with the needs for change. And that's a big task, you know. It's terrible to feel that there's a younger generation feel that they have no role, that they're left out of all the talk that's going on that's about their future. It's very sad for them. I would hope that doesn't translate into decisions made in the future about taking up armed struggle again. And that is a concern, because there's a lot of underlying fear about the changes we're facing into the future. Try and talk in kind of like broad stroke terms, there's one side of the community feels that, you know, the floor's been, carpet's been removed from them, that fearful about this, sure, in the future, that usually means that they have to give up a bit more power. And that's, they perceive it in that terms, as if power is something that one side has when it's something we all should have. You know, and so we have to. We can only overcome those fears by having conversations, having dialogue.
So, as well as what Anne said about storytelling in schools from people who know the effects of violence, I also think, and this is something that I'm doing in my work, is to empower young people to be positive change makers, to learn the skills, to say that actually, you know, it's okay to feel angry and frustrated. There are a lot of things wrong in our society. But these are the kind of skills that can help to change the world non-violently. And I wish that all schools had that on the curriculum. And right now there's a whole range of trainings and courses to work in conflict transformation, prevention, and positive change makers. Like, non-violence has changed a lot over the last 30 years. And I would like to see that in, you know, all schools here and also over in England and about all over the world, because there's so much we can do non-violently, and we have to tell people that the cost of violence is not worth it, and it's absolutely okay to be angry and to want to change, but let's do it without hurting another human being.
You see, as well, there's one side. I mean, I'm coming here, and probably I'm thinking of our friends of mine who have been victims of Republican violence, and they feel very strongly that they've been left behind, that their voices aren't heard, they're ignored, and if they do speak up, they're either called ranting agents who want to hold us all back, that they have to move on, and look at them, they're a pack of bigots, you know, that'll be... You know, instead of respecting them and their different cultures and where they come from, and they see, and it's certainly how I saw when I saw Mary McArdle getting that appointment, They see people being rewarded for murdering. And there has to be some kind of... They have to be listened to, you know. Their concerns have got to be listened to and taken seriously. And a lot of them, you know, they want justice, they want truth, they want to be heard, and they want to be told that they are victims, you know, and that they, their loved ones were worthwhile, their lives were worthwhile.
Okay, folks, what I'd like to do at this stage is I'm going to ask the three folks here maybe to join some of the tables, if that's okay. We'll conclude the formal part of the proceedings. I totally agree with you. Before you go, folks, I totally agree that it's been a very brave and a very worthwhile conversation. Can I just mention, as I did yesterday, our young artist, Selena Coyle, who was helped by Exchange in her Reclaimed project, which she combines recycled materials with traditional jewellery techniques to create very wonderful, unique brooches. And I'd like to present Patrick, Joe and Anne with one of those brooches as a small token of appreciation for what you did for us today.